Spirit Blade Underground Episode 327. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground Episode 327.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and very unique community you're invited to check out at ChristianGeekCentral.com. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. For more info and free goodies, check out SpiritBlade.net. On the show today, Batman Assault on Arkham and The Giver. Two reviews coming up for you. Let's get to it. My father once told me that I could use my powers to make a difference. He told me I had a responsibility to help others. He told me I could save this world. Save everyone. Then he told me, walk the gerbil, walk the gerbil. Freaking weirdo. Batman, Arkham, or Assault on Arkham, sorry. All right, the IMDb synopsis for this movie says, based on the hit video game series, Batman must find a bomb planted by the Joker while dealing with a mysterious team of villains called the Suicide Squad. No, that's totally wrong. It's not totally wrong, but this is not a Batman movie, and that's what is so exciting and refreshing about this. Yes, they think that, you know, all we care about is Batman and Superman, so they got to put Batman really big on the front of the Blu-ray. But this is a Suicide Squad movie. Batman is definitely a part of it, but he's like a background character. If you're not familiar with the Suicide Squad, it's this concept in the DC comic book universe where the U.S. government, headed by a special supervisor named Amanda Waller, basically they cut the sentence time off of villains that are in jail, or I think they just use the ones that are in jail, not the ones that are typically... Well, I think sometimes the ones that are a little bit more stable or controllable in Arkham. Give them a deal of, okay, we'll cut time from your sentence if you go and do these crazy black ops suicide missions that you're probably going to die doing. But if you survive, you'll get such and such years cut off of your sentence. And so it's this great way to get these villains together on a team, kind of doing stuff that's kind of good, but maybe not so good, you know, for the U.S. government. And seeing these villains play off of each other. And what's exciting about a concept like this is with a superhero story, you know that the superheroes have certain limits. They're going to, you know, not kill people, or they're gonna not, you know, whatever. But you just kind of sense those lines are in there. And when I was listening to the commentary for this movie, the creative team even recognized that there's this in this layer of boredom that you have to fight through that's just kind of built into superhero stories and movies like this. But when you take that away, when you take away those lines in the sand, and you just kind of have these characters that who knows what they're gonna do, then you can really do some crazy stuff. You can keep your audience guessing the whole time what the crap is going to happen next. And this movie was just it was a lot of fun. Let's talk briefly about the story, the script, the pacing, that kind of stuff. This is a character-driven movie. As far as like the plot structure, it's a bit of a heist movie. You know, they got to plan this break-in to Arkham Asylum. Amanda Waller is sending the team in to assassinate the Riddler, and the reasons are a bit of a mystery for most of the movie. And meanwhile, Batman's got some other stuff that he's dealing with that eventually kind of that plot line syncs up with what's going on with the Suicide Squad. But you've got these great kind of B-C-list villains. You've got Harley Quinn, who I was sold on as a character. I've never been a fan of Harley Quinn, but she won me over as a character in this movie. You've got Deadshot, who's like this great expert assassin marksman. You've got King Shark. He's kind of a C-lister. You've got Killer Frost, Black Spider, and I want to say like one or two, oh yeah, Captain Boomerang, and maybe one or two others that I'm kind of forgetting. But I mean, these, they don't feel like C-listers when you're watching this movie. I thought for sure this was written by Gail Simone. If you're a comic book fan, then you might recognize that name. Gail Simone wrote The Sinister Six, which was kind of a revival of the concept of the Suicide Squad, except without the government involved. But it was a supervillain team on the run, just kind of doing their own thing. And if you liked Gail Simone's Sinister Six, you should definitely check this movie out. I thought for sure it was written by Gail Simone because the dialogue, the punchlines, every character kind of in these really economic moments is given their chance to shine over and over and over again. And you're seeing how different these characters are, what they're motivated by. You're seeing them bounce off of each other and sometimes really bounce off of each other. And it's just a ton of fun. There's darker senses of humor in this movie. So if you're like me and you like kind of like twisted humor every now and then, this movie will deliver on that. It's definitely violent. It's possibly the most violent of the DC animated movies that I've seen so far. I mean, it really goes to some, whoa, like some somewhat shocking places. But just because it's, you know, dark and violent and gritty and stuff, that doesn't take away from the fun at all. And I think that's something that's kind of missing, maybe, dare I say, from the Marvel movies, is they're fun, but they don't bring in maybe some of the grittiness that I would like as well. I want to have my cake and eat it too, you know. I want the serious, grounded, you know, gritty stuff at times, and sometimes the really shocking violence, but I also want it to be fun at the same time. You think those two are incompatible? Not so in Batman Assault on Arkham. So the characters are a lot of fun. There's great action, great fight choreography. Like I said, the dialogue is great. Let me talk about the actors a little bit. We got Kevin Conroy. You recognize this guy. He's been the voice for Batman in the animated series all through the 90s. He's kind of a fan favorite. And I was starting to get sick of him a little bit because his voice was aging and just kind of the way he was doing his performance as Batman in one of the Batman Superman movies. I think it was the Apocalypse movie. I felt like his age was showing a little bit. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I feel that beholden to Kevin Conroy as Batman anymore. But he did something. I don't know if he was like lubing up, drinking a lot of water or something, but his voice had a youthfulness to it. It sounded like that Batman of the 90s that I remember. It was really great, just kind of return to the prime sound that I used to expect from Kevin Conroy. So that was great. You got Neil McDonough, who I'm probably butchering his name, but you would recognize him. He's a familiar face. He was in Saving Private Ryan. He was the guy with the handlebar mustache in the first Captain America movie. You know that guy. You've seen him everywhere. And he plays Deadshot. I didn't even recognize his voice, but Deadshot is such a great character, and he did a great job. Troy Baker, who like does every voice in video game history, plays the Joker in here, and his Mark Hamill impression is unfreaking canny. I mean, it's nuts. It's nuts. I mean, I had to ask myself for the first couple lines that I heard the Joker speak. I was like, boy, I thought Mark Hamill was done with this. Oh no, I'll bet this is the guy that they got to replace him. At the time, I couldn't remember that it was Troy Baker, but I knew that they got like a rockin' guy to replace him who really could capture that Mark Hamill thing. So, I mean, like if you went in and you didn't know that Mark Hamill has retired from that role, I think you would just go right along with his performance. It is wonderful, classic, animated Joker voice that we've come to expect from years and years of watching the animated series and hearing Mark Hamill do such a brilliant job with that character. CCH Pounder, that's a name you probably for sure don't recognize. But she does the voice of Amanda Waller. She did the voice of Amanda Waller in the animated series. And they put a shout out in the commentary. The one of the creative teams said, hey, this is just a shout out for the people making the live action movies for DC these days. You should hire CCH Pounder to play Amanda Waller when it comes time to represent her in the movies. Now, yes, she was represented by another actress. I can't remember her name in the Green Lantern movie, but I don't think with the new DC movies, they're at all considering that canon. So as long as they're going to recast that role, yeah, I think go with CCH Pounder, because I think not only is her voice, but if you've seen her, I've seen her on like TV dramas and stuff like that, and she would physically, she would be great for it, for her appearance and just kind of like the intensity that she can bring as an actress. Oh man, I would love to see her as Amanda Waller in a live action movie, and it's great to hear her voice again doing that role that she just so classically created. I mean, she didn't create Amanda Waller, but I mean her interpretation of the source material in the DC animated animated universe of the 90s and 2000s. It was fantastic. Let's talk a little bit about visuals. Okay, this is an animated movie, Cell animated, not CG, although there is some CG brought in to kind of enhance some things here and there. But the fight choreography is really great, really creative and fast and furious. And I'm like looking around like, whoa, whoa, it's just great to watch some of the combat in this movie. Whenever Batman comes into the scene, you know, it just really amps it up. But it's great even the rest of the time. The one criticism I would have visually is that every once in a while the art lines are a little bit thick and a little bit... Because what they'll do is they'll create the scene and then they'll zoom in a little bit. And so it loses, when you zoom in on cell animation, it loses some of that definition because they're not creating new art as they zoom in. They're just zooming in on this art resource that they've already created for maybe a wider shot, but when they zoom in, it loses some of that definition, some of that clean look, and it gets a little the black lines get a little bit thick, and it just kind of looks a little bit sloppy. But that doesn't happen very often. I could probably count on one hand the times where I thought, oh, that doesn't look great. You know, the rest of the time, the animation, the art looks great. It's the color scheme and just kind of the interpretations of how they designed the physicality of the characters, their costumes and stuff. Now, this is based on the universe of the Batman Arkham Asylum games. Arkham Asylum, Arkham City, Arkham Origins, all that stuff. And I haven't played a single one of those games because I suck at them. But watching this movie, you don't need to know anything about those games, anything about that universe. It could just be, you know, this kind of what if self-contained Batman story that mostly fits in with the rest of the DC universe. And in fact, I can't help but wonder if I was familiar with the games, if I would be bringing baggage into this movie experience that would kind of like, I don't know, hurt it somehow. I had a great experience, and I know jack about the Arkham series of games. The music and sound effects in this movie, well, the sound effects are great. I'm not going to talk about those, though. But the musical choices are fantastic. They got like some rock every now and then that's kind of like, you know, yeah, we are bad mother truckers, you know, and we're coming out and we're doing our slow motion walk down the hall, you know, and because we just did something awesome, we're all suited up now, and you know. And so they use the music to help create these moments that you've felt and that you've seen and that you've experienced in classic movies like this. I think of heist movies like Ocean's 11 or these kinds of like, or I don't want to say the Expendables. I'm not a huge fan of the Expendables, but that kind of movie where it's this ensemble team that's coming together to carry out a plan, you know. So it's definitely that kind of thing, and they create a lot of those moments with the music. They also do some interesting thing with the editing. You know, they'll have like these little a sliced up screen that has multiple close-ups on the different characters, you know. This movie just knows how to have fun in the way that it tells the story, you know. It's still lots of, you know, dark, violent stuff going on, but the way the story is told is very fun a lot of the time. Now, in terms of like relevance, things that might stimulate worthwhile thought or conversation or contemplation, I don't think there's really much going on in this movie that's going to do that. You know, I mean, you might say, boy, you know, the back of the Blu-ray says get ready to root for the villains or the bad guys or whatever. And you might ask yourself, well, boy, should we ever root for, you know, these bad guys, you know? But then that kind of demands the question to be asked, you know, what is a bad guy? You know, I mean, we don't want to root for evil itself. We don't want to root for what is wrong itself. But I mean, how do you define bad guy, you know? And especially when these guys, even though they're screwed up themselves and they've done horrible things and they're going to keep doing horrible things, they are on a mission to do horrible things to people that are possibly more horrible than them, you know. So there is a sense in which you can get along with, you know, go along with them, and they also take pains, especially with Deathstroke, to make him a little bit relatable. They kind of bring in the fact that he's got this daughter that he cares about, that he's protecting, and so you get this, especially Deadshot, and he's kind of the centerpiece of the ensemble cast, and so he really, I think, helps to enable us to root for the villains. And the other villains, you know, you start feeling, you know, like you can side with them a little bit just because they're funny, you know, and you know, you don't take them too seriously. It's a lot of fun. It's rated PG-13 for violence, sexual content, and language. Let's see, I'm going to give this one a 9.0 out of 10. This is a fantastic movie. Now, keep in mind, I'm a fan of DC Comics. If you're not a fan of DC Comics, then that maybe that would be for you more like an 8 or an 8.5, you know, a good experience, but not one that you're like, oh my gosh, I'm so glad I saw that right away, you know? But if you are if you're a fan of the DC Universe and you're familiar with lots of the different characters in the DC Universe, even if you're not familiar with all of them, I wasn't really familiar at all with King Shark, but most of the others I'd at least heard of and maybe had seen them featured in a story, you know, once before. But if you have, you know, that level of knowledge or even a little less knowledge than that of the DC Universe, but you're just a fan of the DC Universe, I think this is a must buy for you. A must buy. I mean, you don't have to run out and get it today, but man, you if you wait, you might feel like, oh, my life could have been better for the last 2 months if I would have bought this. No. But it's a great experience. I highly recommend. Relevance, you know, they're not trying for anything, and they're not bringing anything that's really worthwhile in terms of thought or contemplation, in my opinion. So I'm going to give them a 5.5 out of 10 in that regard. The Giver. In a seemingly perfect community without war, pain, suffering, differences, or choice, a young boy is chosen to learn from an elderly man about the true pain and pleasure of the real world. So this is it's a utopian dystopian future. Basically, this big event called the Ruin took place, after which they decided to just remove emotions and feelings and to a large degree choice out of society. And so everyone at a certain age is given the role that they're assigned, the role that they will fulfill for the rest of their lives. And one 18-year-old young man named Jonas discovers that he has been chosen to basically learn from the past, because everyone's memory of human history has been wiped, and only one person in each generation serves as the caretaker of that information, who's chosen to feel and chosen to learn and recall memories of human history. Let's talk about the story, script, and the pacing a little bit. This is a quiet concept movie. Now, it's not boring. I don't want to say it's boring, but it's more interesting than it is involving. I cared about the community and kind of what would happen to them, whether or not they would change, whether or not they would set aside the harmful ideals that they've been holding on to that's really stagnated them as human beings. I wanted them to grow and come out of that, but I didn't really care about any individual person. So I don't want to say that it's character driven, even though it sometimes I feel like it wants to believe that it is. It's really more of a concept movie that you're likely to walk away from saying, boy, that was interesting, rather than, oh my gosh, you know, wow, that was an experience, you know. Let's talk about the actors a little bit. We got Jeff Bridges, who plays the older generation of what's called the receiver, who receives these memories. He's now passing these memories on to the young Jonas. We've got Meryl Streep, who is the eldest head honcho of the elders, and she's kind of like provides the antagonism in the movie. Like, no, we have to do things the way we've always done them. That's Meryl Streep's job. We got Brenton Thwaites. I don't know this guy from anywhere. He's the 18-year-old lead character, Jonas. We've got Odea Rush, who is kind of the romantic interest of the movie for him. And we've got Katie Holmes as the other recognizable face, who plays his mother. The roles are really not defined very well in this movie, because family relationships we take for granted are kind of sterilized in this movie. In fact, emotions in general, the highs and lows, I should say, are kind of sterilized in this movie, because the characters are all required to take these daily doses, these injections that deaden their emotions. Sound familiar, Equilibrium fans? You better believe I was making comparisons to Equilibrium during this whole movie. But what Equilibrium does better, I mean, apart from being like this action, you know, thinking man's, you know, sci-fi movie, is that it allows for some of the greater, some, it allows for more emotion in the characters. The characters all in this entire community had their emotions deadened to the point of being just like artificial, superficial, weird, you know, and stuff like that. And that's part of the reason it was hard to invest in them. Now, what I really would have liked for them to do is after some key characters begin feeling emotions, as is inevitable in a movie with, that's based in this concept, I would love for those characters that are feeling to really give performances that that pull me in to... I would have liked some dramatic heavy hitters in this. I felt like they cast some, maybe some rising stars, you know, some people that fit the roles, that had that were beautiful young actors and stuff, and maybe they are dramatic heavy hitters just waiting to happen, but it didn't come out in their performances. Maybe it was the direction in the movie. I don't know, you know, where where we should point to see the cause for that, but whatever the reason, I didn't feel emotionally invested in their performances. I think that artistically, what would have been a better choice was to really let them cut loose with these new emotions that they're discovering, and just so that we could really feel their pain, their fear, their anxiety, you know, their passion, their love, their compassion, you know, all those different things. I would have really loved to feel right along with them, and the movie just didn't bring me to that point. As far as like the stunts and visuals, they're not pushing visuals at all in this movie. The visual effects are just enough to get the job done. They start out with a black and white filter on everything. So there's no color for like the first, I want to say, 10, 15 minutes. Color is slowly introduced as Jonas begins experiencing feelings and other sensations that he hadn't had before. But, you know, we've seen that before. We saw that in, what was that? I can't even remember the movie. I think I saw half of it with a dude who was Spider-Man before he was Pleasantville, that's what it's called, where he started out black and white, and then as feelings and stuff are introduced, and then color gets introduced and stuff like that. So I felt like that device has been used before. You know, it was fine. I got what they were telling us, what they were going for, but it didn't feel very creative to me. What I would be interested in doing, you know, as film and especially home video is being defined more and more by like the clarity of the picture, you know, like we got 1080p and now we got like these 4K televisions or whatever, you know, that are going to be increasing the fidelity of the picture. I'd be interested in seeing this kind of an idea presented in terms of focus or in terms of fidelity, you know, or at least fidelity in addition to coloring. You know, it would have been cool when he was experiencing emotions for the first time to introduce color and make it really rich color, but at the same time also, you know, increase the clarity of the picture. Like maybe just keep it slightly fuzzy all before that, and maybe do something similar with the sound. You know, mental note to myself as an audio drama producer that would be kind of a cool device to have a slightly muffled, slightly, you know, less clear sound. And then when you do something like this that introduces sensations to a character that they hadn't had before, to suddenly increase the treble maybe, or just bring more crystal clarity to everything. So I would have been interested in some different choices to represent that discovery of emotion and sensation. The music and sound in this movie is fine, but it's forgettable. So moving on now to relevance. You know, is there anything in this movie that that provokes potentially worthwhile thought or conversation? And I think that there is. It won't provoke it in everybody, but I think it is. There's a strong tendency for it there. The big question, I think, that's examined in the film that's really central to the resolution of the plot is, free will. Is free will and the range of emotions that come with it worth the cruelty and the suffering that's caused by humanity? That's a big question. There are kind of some extreme views here. Now, in a movie that's exploring this kind of idea, the views can often be even more extreme. You know, you'll have one side that's saying, no, we got to be free to just follow our heart and do what we want to do and just murder people, you know. I mean, they don't say that last part, but really that's, you know, that's the natural consequence of living this kind of life where you're just following your heart and just do what your passion tells you to do, you know. And then you've got, predictably, the other side is like, no, all emotions are evil. All choice is evil. We must cut it all out and be freaking robots, you know. And, you know, I don't think either one of those views, obviously, is the right one. In this movie, the control freaks were a little bit more like that classic representation. In fact, one of the characters at one point says, when given the choice, humans will always choose evil every time. And I'm like, really? Is that really your view? Can you just be a little bit more balanced, you know, so that it's not so obvious that you have the bad view, the wrong view in this movie. But I was grateful that of those that took the other position of like wanting to have emotions, wanting to have choice, that they did acknowledge very poignantly and dramatically at some points that with choice comes pain, comes suffering, comes cruelty. At first, that cruelty is represented as harm to animals. And I was like, really, is that how they're going to represent the potential cruelty of humanity? But they later introduced more results of human choice that really are that are harmful to humans and that are really tragic and about real human suffering, so I was glad that that they moved on from suffering by animals, even though obviously I think that's terrible, Anyway, let's see here. The other question I think that the movie brings up is, are faith and love emotions? Now, I don't think that the movie really tries to ask this question. Rather, it portrays faith and love as emotions, which makes me want to say, whoa, really? Is that how we're going to define faith? Unfortunately, that's how faith is usually defined in popular culture. Faith is thought of as this thing that you just kind of, you just believe even though you don't have any good reasons to believe. You just believe with all your feelings. You just force yourself to believe. And, I guess maybe people, a lot of people, have that view of faith, but scripturally speaking, faith, the Greek word for faith, is much more like our word for trust, where trust is not by nature blind. Faith is not by nature blind, But oftentimes we just think of faith as blind faith, even though we don't use the expression blind faith. We think of all faith as being blind, but that's not the case. It's certainly not scripturally. Faith is like trust. It's something that can and should be earned based on the evidence that's available. Has someone earned your trust? Has someone earned the faith that you're placing in them? And then also love. Love obviously has emotional components, but I would argue that love is a virtue. Love is a choice. Love is a value. It is not simply an emotion, because emotions come and go, with our feelings and all that kind of stuff. So I would disagree that love is that kind of a thing, at least not love of any value. When I think of love, I think of love that is a choice, that certainly a lot of emotion comes along with it, but it is a choice. It's a commitment. It's a virtue. So I think the idea of, faith and love as presented in this movie are a little wonky, but because of how they're presented, it might stimulate some worthwhile thought. Now, a little further down on the list of what things I think this movie might likely make you think about is abortion. There is a possible, and I'm not even sure at all about this, but there is a very small chance that there is a pro-life abortion stance being taken by the writer of this film that's intentional or not. Maybe the author, if they randomly ended up seeing this video, would say, "Are you insane? I would never, go along with the pro-life, stance on abortion, But what's interesting is in this movie, and this is a bit of a spoiler. I think it's a minor spoiler. It's not a big shock when you see it in the movie, But in this movie, the babies, for some reason, are categorized at birth. They're weighed, and if they don't weigh enough or if they're not strong enough, they get released. And, you find out that releasing is killing, later on in the movie. So sorry, that is a bit of a spoiler. I'll try to put a note in the notes that there are some minor spoilers in this video. So what we have here is a baby that, because it doesn't weigh enough, because it's not quite strong enough, it is killed. It is murdered. And when the main character discovers this, he's like, "We haven't gotten rid of murder. We've just given a new name to it." So he was calling that act murder. Now, what's interesting is that there are some folks that choose, after discovering that their child has Down syndrome or some other condition that's just going to make the child's life and make the parent's life much more challenging and difficult, there are parents that will choose to abort that child. The pro-life position would say, "No, you shouldn't abort that. That's life. That's life. And what you're doing there is murder." it would be interesting to find out that the author does not have a pro-life view in mind or in their heart at some point, even if that they didn't intend to express it, because I can see a metaphor being used here by people who take the pro-life position to say, boy, you know, see, this is an example of what we're talking about, you know, when we're talking about how this is murder and people are just giving another name to it. So I don't want to get into a big old stink and conversation about the pro-life, pro-choice whole issues, but I just wanted to mention that I do think that is potentially a theme that was in mind when this movie was being written, or it's based on a book, so maybe when the book was being written, but I don't know. If you see the movie, you let me know in the comments if you think that was intentional or not, or what you think is going on there. I'd be curious what your take on that is. Okay, well, the movie's rated PG-13 for mature thematic images and some sci-fi action violence. In the end, I give it a quality score of 7.5 out of 10. You know, it's an average experience for me. It was interesting, but I wanted more emotional involvement and intensity in my experience. If I were a time traveler, I'd go back and tell myself, Pater, rent or catch this on TV if the premise sounds interesting to you, but you know, don't run out and think you need to see it. In terms of relevance, I give it an 8.0 out of 10. It doesn't demand thought, but I do think it still lends itself to some thought if you kind of want to go there. So there you have it, my thoughts on The Giver. I want to remind you guys to check out the other podcasts in the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, and the Untold podcast. For more info about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com. Feedback, input, I want to hear from you guys. Request a review, give me your thoughts, questions, whatever. It all helps me make the show better. Go to spiritblade.net/underground to record a message with your computer, or send me an email at paeter@spiritblade.net. All right. Before I forget, the first episode, like I mentioned this last week, the first episode of the Christian Geek Central video game show Trial and Error is up on the Christian Geek Central channel on YouTube, and at Christian Geek Central, if you scroll down to not the most recent post, but maybe a few posts back. And I've also posted videos of this week's reviews for Batman Assault on Arkham and what was the other one? The Giver. That's right. Oh, and before I get any emails, yes, and I corrected this and made fun of myself in the video version. Yes, I did not mean Sinister Six in Batman Assault on Arkham. I meant Secret Six. That's what you get when you do an uncut format, especially when you do. And I didn't, and I've stopped to like writing out my reviews in advance. I just kind of, you know. Huge blunder on my part. The Secret Six, a great series by Gail Simone. And if you are a fan of that, totally check out Batman Assault on Arkham. If you like Batman Assault on Arkham, go check out Gail Simone's The Secret Six. I think they might be available in a trade paperback by now, but I'm not sure about that. But anyway, if you've already, you know, listened to these reviews, I'd still love it if you'd go to Christian Geek Central on YouTube. That's just one word. Christian Geek Central is the name of our channel. And click like on these videos so that we can trick people into thinking that these are great videos and lots of people like them so that maybe they'll check them out too. Christian Geek Central, one word, is the name of the channel. And if you'd be interested in helping to create content, please email me for more information at paeter@spiritblade.net. You guys probably noticed that there was no In Search of Truth segment this week. That's just kind of been the nature of this month a little bit. I'm kind of in between two different types of schedules here at home in terms of how my life operates, because both of my boys were home from school during the summer, so I had a totally different schedule arranged to work around that. And then my oldest went back to school at the beginning of August, but my youngest doesn't go back to school until September. So it's my schedule's all weird, and I'm kind of falling behind in several areas of life, and that's one of them. Also, my dad had some medical stuff going on that he was getting tests about, so I was kind of preoccupied and a little extra drained because of that. So anyway, it's not my intention to let that segment fall by the wayside, and I anticipate that if not, you know, starting next week, then certainly in September, when my schedule's, you know, kind of locked in and more predictable, that it won't be near as frequent, that segment is left by the wayside. Let's see here. Okay, yeah, that's it, guys. Stay tuned for Farscape Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 310 if you want to start from the very beginning. Next week, if God wants it to happen, well, con season is basically over as far as like tabletop gaming conventions go. And so I'm basically going to be scouring the internet for all the interesting game announcements and previews and stuff that are catching my eye. And I'll be sharing those and my thoughts on them with you next week. Till then, thanks so much for making time for this show. I really appreciate it. I hope you have a great week and that you join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Peter Frentzen with support from the Christian Geek Central community at christiangeekcentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit spiritblade.net. Thank you for listening.
Prepare for immediate starburst.
Right, episode 118, A Bug's Life, and congratulations, we are now, in my opinion, past the hump. the greatest concentration of disappointing episodes are behind us now. This is where, I would say starting with this episode, this is where the series just kind of begins to kick into high gear. Anyway, but just talking about this episode, I can never remember which episode is what based on the title. I always get the plot wrong in my mind. This was a totally different episode than what I was thinking. Let's see here. We see Crichton kind of trying to put on this charade of being a peacekeeper. I can't remember. Is this the first time we've seen that? I can't remember now. Oh, yeah. I think he did it with the, what do you call it? Yeah. Whoever they were. But anyway, not the best accent, Ben Browder, I'm sorry to say. Doing kind of like a, going for like a British type thing. Doesn't seem to quite be all the way there. But, you know, you could certainly argue, okay, well, this is an astronaut, you know? So, I mean, it's not like he was a trained actor anyway, you know. So, and the fact that he's using the accent at all just makes you wonder about the whole translator microbe thing and how that factors in. But, you know, this is Farscape, so you just kind of go along with it because they're doing other things really well. At least that's how I feel about it. Love the DRDs in that opening scene, man. What a power play for him to just, like, on command have this barrage of blaster fire coming from the DRDs. I mean, what a force to be reckoned with that, you know, we didn't even realize, you know, even though we should have based on what we've seen them capable of in the past. So this story is, you know, it's John Carpenter's The Thing, which is my all-time favorite monster movie. And so it doesn't bother me at all that they're totally ripping off of that plot, which itself was based on an earlier story, I believe. Anyway, this is kind of a classic, you know, who's got the, who's possessed, you know, or who's not themselves or whatever. And they even did, like, the biological testing and stuff. I mean, it was very much, you know, from the John Carpenter's The Thing playbook. But that made it no less enjoyable to me. Again, for me, it's not about the story. It's not about how original or well-crafted the story is. It's about taking these characters and throwing them into a weird situation and seeing how they react. And it was just a lot of fun to see these characters react. Looks like, you know, even though things were going in a good direction with Erin and Crichton, that they're not all sunshine and rainbows. You know, she was clearly very disappointed in him and in his plan, and in his ability to execute on that plan. You know, she made the remark of, you know, I wish that uniform would have fit me, you know, because I would have done a much better job than you, you know. So there's still a lot of insecurity in that relationship. It's very, there's still, you know, yeah, it's fun to see that kind of back and forth and see how the relationship evolves. I mean, and they have to do that. They have to, what I appreciate about it is that unlike other fiction of this type, serialized fiction like comic books or a weekly TV show, you often have the leading man bounce from relationship to relationship to relationship, and they don't really do that in Farscape. Okay, so this is kind of a bit of a spoiler. But they're not really going to do that with John. What we get to watch for most of the series is his relationship with Aaron, you know. What I like about it is that even though they've established the relationship beginning, you know, right around here, it's not that it's never in danger. It's not that it doesn't have its ups and downs. It's not that it's guaranteed to last forever. There's still risk involved. And, you know, I wish that they would do something like this more often with married characters in fiction, you know, so that we'd realize that, you know, there's still drama, there's still conflict, you know. And of course, in TV, they have to take that conflict to extremes in order for us to really feel it. Whereas, you know, my relationship with Holly, we're in no danger at all of getting divorced. But you know, do we still have like these kind of like moments where we didn't communicate really well, and so there's conflict or there's stress, you know, in our home? Yes, absolutely. You know, so when you have a stable relationship, a committed relationship that is not in any danger of being broken up or whatever, that does not remove the, you know, the tension, the drama, the felt conflict, you know. And so I appreciate a long-lasting relationship being displayed in fiction that isn't sunshine and rainbows and has its ups and downs. And you know, speaking of which, it's, you know, it's not really much to speak of here. Larrack wasn't really a serious romantic threat to John, but what he did present to Aaron again was this chance to go and be with her people, you know, and to fit in, you know, and to belong. And you could just see in her eyes and see in her interaction with Larrack that she does want that, you know. Just a good character episode. I don't really have anything more to say about it. I just enjoyed it. It's, I think one of the things that starts to define Farscape is, I want to say a serious tone, but that's not right, because it definitely maintains its humor, but it does get maybe darker, and the humor is kind of playing against that darkness. Whereas you take an episode like IET is really pretty light for most of the episode. There's, you know, it's a lot of light kind of comedy, you know. It's and there's several episodes in the first season that are kind of on the lighter side of things. And even though the humor doesn't go away, in fact, I would say that the humor gets more crazy and left field and just like breaking boundaries funny as the series goes on. I think it does that. The humor gets more extreme and the drama and the intensity and the action becomes more extreme. And I would say that A Bug's Life, this episode, is probably the beginning of that. It really starts to kick in, I would say, with the next two episodes, Nerve and The Hidden Memory. I think it's in Nerve, if not The Hidden Memory, where a villain is introduced that is probably my favorite villain of all film, whether it's TV or a movie. I just am fascinated with, I love to hate, and sometimes hate to love this villain. So I can't wait to talk about him. Hopefully in next episode, 119, Nerve.